I Hate Politics is a podcast dedicated to exploring a human activity we love to hate. We look at human life, culture, economics closest to us, in our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and in our local governments. Together, we'll explore how politics is central to getting things done in societies where we treasure diverse views and preferences. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. I've spent my life studying politics, and I know this. Unless we want to live in a dictatorship or a monarchy, we are stuck with politics. Politics is more than just Trump, Biden, or elections. It's how we fix potholes, make our streets safer, where we put our schools, and decide who goes to them. It's about coming together as a community. It's about us. Let's go find those stories. The Maryland General Assembly ended its 2021 session with historic new legislation on public safety. Maryland was the first state to establish a Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights in the 1970s, and now has become the first state to repeal the law. In this episode, I talk with Maryland State House Delegate from Montgomery County, Gabriel Acevero, who together with Senator Jill Carter of Baltimore has been a leading voice for police reform and accountability in the state. Two key elements of a bill they have been pushing for a few years, called Anton's Law, use of force and transparency in officer misconduct, made it into the new laws passed this session. Anton's Law is named after Anton Black, who was killed by an officer in Greensboro, Maryland in 2018. The reform legislation package also addressed body cameras and storage of body camera footage, which has proven to be critical as evidence in several cases involving excessive use of force by the police. Maryland legislators have now put themselves ahead of other states, looking at police reform and accountability, and command considerable attention as others look here for how to do this right. Since the death of George Floyd in 2020, a national movement for police reform and accountability has called for defunding the police. Since Derek Chauvin's just concluded trial, the U.S. Department of Justice has launched an investigation of the Minneapolis Police Department. As expected, police officers and police departments resist the changes, but institutionally, the big X factor is how the Maryland Police Training and Standards Commission, a body that sets training standards for the entire state, shapes the legislative language for implementation by police departments. The commission is primarily comprised of police officers, chiefs, sheriffs. Maryland and Montgomery County Senator Will Smith Jr., who chairs the state Senate's Judicial Proceedings Committee, and held out longer than most on getting the language of the public safety bills right, sits on the commission as well, but in an advisory capacity. The commission, as it stands today, is a recent 2016 creation of the State General Assembly. Full disclosure, Delegate Acevero used to be a student of mine at UMBC between 2009 and 2011, and it was great to be able to ask him questions again. Also in this episode, we use music from a locally composed full-length musical, Sunflower, The Story of Amelie and Vincent. Composer Primula Mistry is a music teacher in DC public schools. Her collaborator, Laura Gulley, used to live in Northern Virginia, but now lives in Texas. The choir includes DCPS students. If you want to showcase your music on the podcast or know someone else who does, please email ihppod@gmail.com. But first, the news roundup. You may not know it, but it's election time for secondary students in Montgomery County Public Schools who elect the student member of the County Board of Education, also called the SMOB. This year, the contest is between two Richard Montgomery High School students, Henry Kay and Hannah O'Looney. Richard Montgomery seems to have something of a lock on the smart position and will provide 3 and 4 years, including the coming one. Campaigning this year has been more intense than in the past. Voting should be completed by Friday, April 23rd, and we should have results shortly thereafter. Worth noting that the student member is a full member of the board with voting rights on almost all matters. Because student members have tended to have progressive politics, some conservative residents in neighboring Howard County tried to strip the student member of voting powers there. They were unsuccessful. Since March 1st, 2021, Montgomery County Public Schools has been reopening buildings to larger and larger number of students, and this week of April 18th has been the largest return yet. If you're a student or a teacher listening and want to share your experience of return, you can send us a 30 to 45 second voice letter, email to ihppod@gmail.com. While comprehensive numbers are not yet available, anecdotally, West County schools are reporting higher numbers of returning students. Many schools are 75% back. In East County, however, the return percentages are much lower, some as low as 30. MCPS Superintendent Jack Smith has said that the school system has 1,200 students waitlisted for return. There's long been an east-west divide in the county in the resources available to schools, but an east-west pattern of return remains noteworthy regardless. A larger percentage of returnees in the West means that schools have to put fewer resources to continued online learning and to something MCPS calls support to virtual, which is a term it uses for students who go to school buildings but learn on Zoom from there. In East County schools, higher learn from home numbers mean school resources are divided between online, in-person, and support to virtual learning models. This difference is showing up as frustration in East County student voices. On the eve of Earth Day 2021, about 40 climate activists showed up in front of Montgomery County Executive Office in Rockville demanding immediate climate action.
This is what democracy looks like.
Climate action! Climate water! Now!
Climate action!
The protest was organized by, among others, students from Sunrise Rockville and members of the Extinction Rebellion, which are local climate action groups. The demonstrators were critical of County Executive Mark Elrich for doing little after declaring a climate emergency. The students were also very upset with Elrich's dismissal of them as worthy interlocutors. Not sure if County Executive Elrich was looking down from his office. The entire executive office complex remains COVID empty. But politicians are consequentialists and would surely look at the small gathering and wonder how much the bulk of the county residents really cared about climate action. The talk of following science masks the pursuit of votes, or conversely, the neglect of issues where voters seem to be disinterested. Montgomery and Loudoun County Departments of Transportation have agreed to conduct a joint study of how to bring back White's Ferry, the crossing on the Potomac River that has been in operation for nearly 200 years. An early episode of this podcast examined the White's Ferry debacle, the long-running commercial dispute between the ferry operator and a landowner on the Virginia side finally closed the ferry down in January 2021. The ferry's owner sold the operation to Chuck Kuhn of JK Moving, a Loudoun County resident, but the sale did not bring a resolution. The landowners on the Loudoun side want a piece of the operations and appear to have as deep pockets as Chuck Kuhn and are willing to fight it out. The involvement of two county governments opens the possibility of acquiring the Virginia landing site with eminent domain finding a new landing spot, or starting a publicly owned ferry service. Over in Fairfax, the local government passed laws removing age restrictions on who could rent basements and accessory dwelling units or in-law suites. Montgomery County broadly legalized accessory dwelling units recently. The county does not require landlords to get a rental license when renting to five unrelated people if the landlord lives on the premises. Unclear what happens for non-residential landlords with basements and ADUs. Meanwhile, in Tacoma Park, the decades-long political fight over redeveloping Tacoma Junction, a landmark site for a much-beloved co-op store, has heated up again and brought out protesters, to which our friends at the Tacoma Torch said this: Tacoma Park celebrates Earth Day by preserving low-density suburb with lots of parking. Recently, Tacoma Park marked a bold new era with the sale of one single-family home for $1.7 million. Montgomery County Council member Craig Rice has proposed legislation that would require panhandlers to get a permit before asking for money on the streets. The permit would be free, and Rice justified it in the name of pedestrian safety. Having been to memorials for nearly all pedestrians who died on county streets in the last 3 years, I can say with some certainty that panhandlers are generally not who were killed. What this law really does is to make the already difficult lives of the poor even more difficult. The county council will listen to testimony on the bill May 11th. You can sign up to speak. Darion Pollard, president of Montgomery College, has applied for a new job to be president of the Nevada State College. The Montgomery College presidency is one of the big three education jobs in the county. MCPS superintendent and the university's of Shady Grove executive director are the other two. If she decides to leave, the county will be filling two of three positions this year. I'll be back with Gabriel Assembly. Gabriel Severo, welcome to I Hit Politics.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You were one of the leaders of the police reform and accountability laws that the General Assembly passed in 2021. And what are the highlights?
Yeah, so I think it's important just to take a couple of minutes to talk about how we got here, because last year, in the midst of all the protests nationally over the killing of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and so many other Black, Latinx, Indigenous people of color in this country, there was a movement right here in Maryland, particularly within the General Assembly, to look at the issue of police accountability. And a work group was set up by House Speaker Adrian Jones. And I was honored to have been appointed to that work group that included both Democrats as well as Republicans and folks from different backgrounds. Over the past 10 months, we listened to impacted communities. We listened to subject matter experts. We listened to law enforcement, as well as prosecutors, public defenders, and a number of folks. And what we developed was a report that was later published. We were really charged with four areas. One, ensuring that all law enforcement were equipped with body cameras, but also looking at storage. We also looked at the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights, which is a law that Maryland is the first state to have passed in the early 1970s, that a number of other states have since followed suit, that in essence provide officers accused of misconduct with procedural protections and ensuring that, you know, there's no kind of a community oversight and control, really. And so we were supposed to look at whether to reform it or repeal it. The third thing was around use of force, and the viability of a statewide use of force standard, but also ensuring that we are including criminal implications for those law enforcement officers who do not follow that use of force standard. And then lastly was independent investigations and prosecutions of cases of police-involved killings, injury. And so we issued that report from the work group shortly after. And a number of legislators sort of went to work in introducing their bills. I've been introducing police accountability legislation since being elected to the House. One such bill is called Anton's Law, named after Anton Black, a 19-year-old college athlete that was killed in police custody on the Eastern Shore.
So you've been working on this for a number of years, especially since Anton Black's death. But this year was special. What do you think happened this year that allowed this extraordinary package to go forward?
I think the movement nationally really helped that. But also, I think credit should go to Speaker Adrian Jones, who had decided to set up this work group to look at these really important areas, to not just put forth a report that people could look at, but for us to then say, okay, this can be translated into legislation.
Let me ask you about the use of force standard. What was it before and how did it change?
Well, that's the thing. There wasn't a standard. And according to the Supreme Court, because it was really off a Supreme Court ruling, that it was what the officer deemed as reasonable, or if he, she, or they, in essence, were reasonably in fear of their lives. And the problem with that is that that's what a lot of officers used, right? You know, I feared for my life, so that's why I did this. You know, I saw him with a Skittles bag and I thought it was a gun and I feared for my life. And I did that. That was the standard before. And I wouldn't really call it a standard because what it was really based on Supreme Court ruling.
What is it? No.
Justified. Is the force justifiable, but also is it proportionate?
So that's a big change. What do you think will need to change in the training organization of police departments to bring that about?
I'm of the belief that, you know, because we focus so much on like training and training whenever we see instances of police violence, and it just sort of takes away from, you know, really the deep structural work that we need to be doing. So for example, according to the BI statistics, you know, officers have received more firearm training than they have de-escalation training.
Well, I'm not saying that there should be more firearm training. Whether it's de-escalation training or conflict resolution training or whatever training that you want, it's still training. And so how do you see police departments changing?
Now that we've sort of created that framework, it's then the responsibility of agencies and the folks in charge of the training and hiring of officers to ensure that those individuals are not just aware, but trained. And that's the responsibility of police academies. It's also the responsibility, in my mind, of the Maryland Police Trainings and Standards Commission. It's the responsibility of the police chiefs.
That's interesting. So there's a Maryland State Training and Standards Commission for the police?
So there's a Maryland Police Trainings and Standards Commission, which in essence is responsible for not just the kind of training and standards, but also the certification of officers. Right. And this is what made the whole Anton Black case so relevant, is that Webster, when he was an officer in Dover, Delaware, had multiple use of force reports and complaints on his record. The former police chief of Greensboro, police department in Greensboro, Maryland, intentionally withheld that information from Webster's background and did not provide it to the Maryland Police Trainings and Standards Commission in order for him to be certified.
The Training and Standards Commission now, do they get to interpret essentially for the departments the new laws that you've passed?
This is going to take the work of a number of agencies, from the Maryland State Police to the Maryland Police Trainings and Standards Commissions to local government, because we've done a good bit as well around body cameras, the establishment of police accountability boards. So it's going to be a good bit of folk.
If you look at the membership of these kinds of groups, right, they are from the police, they are trained in the old school, you know, and they now have the ability to interpret your law. So what is the mechanism you have to monitor all these various agencies that are now, you've now suddenly made responsible for bringing about these changes?
Well, these agencies have always been charged with this area, the responsibility of not just law enforcement agencies, police chiefs, but also the Maryland Police Trainings and Standards Commission.
Correct.
To ensure that that is the kind of a standard we're following in the training as well.
How will you monitor them is the question.
Well, we have oversight of agencies. There's also, I know there's some mechanisms, some language that we put in there around reporting, around use of force, et cetera. And if agencies do not report, then that could mean a restriction of funds. Sure. There are several mechanisms for oversight, but yeah, we wanted to ensure that what we do is clear and agencies understand what needs to be implemented.
Right? Is there a funding piece in this entire package of laws?
I think what we're looking at is a state and local effort to ensure that we're funding body cameras, because we not only have local law enforcement, we also have state, right? Maryland state troopers.
So now we have a good set of understandings of, you know, what the law does and what you're hoping it'll do. A big part of this depends on how the police departments behave. You know, your efforts have been opposed by police unions. What is your expectation going forward about how departments are going to react to this new law?
Not to sound curt, but it doesn't matter what departments think in terms of our new law. I think the responsibility of agencies is to implement those laws that we pass. I can tell you what the position of the Fraternal Order of Police is, but in terms of police chiefs, you know, there have been some who have come to Annapolis and sheriffs to testify in support of police reform, and they supported some, you know, and not taken a position on others.
Maybe this is not the right analogy, but my experience with adult humans.
Adult humans.
No, and this is a good one. As adult humans, especially in my classrooms, even I can't get students to do what I want unless they want to do it themselves. And here we are talking about police officers that have a certain sense of their own self. And you are saying it doesn't matter what they think. I'm not sure it doesn't matter. I mean, you've got to take into account at some point how they feel about it and how and whether they are going to cooperate or not. Have you thought about that?
During the work group, we've heard from a number of stakeholders in this conversation, right? And that's part of the reason why we had the work group and we had these many listening sessions and hearings. And I can tell you this, we pass a lot of bills where agencies are usually opposed to, right? Mm-hmm. Because really no agency likes it when you're in essence telling them that your way of doing things has to change. Right. And it has to change drastically in order to serve a very diverse community and constituency, right? Sure. And so I think when it comes to police departments and police officers, I mean, you know, this is not an none of this is anti-police legislation. We are talking about building community trust. The biggest threat to a good police officer is a crooked one, right? And we have a responsibility of creating a system where we root out those corrupt, racist and abusive cops so that the profession and those who entered it for the right reasons and are doing it for the right reasons, right, aren't being painted with that broad brush, but also are able to do their jobs with dignity without thinking that the community views them a particular way or because of the actions of, you know, other individuals, right? So this is really about, you know, transforming policing, but it's also about, you know, those folks who are doing the good work each and every single day, walking the beat, connecting with the community.
We'll be right back. I've heard you speak to the teachers union and you are stirring. And so you're a great supporter of collective action and collective bargaining. But when it comes to police unions, you haven't taken that kindly. Conceptually, how do you draw a line between collective bargaining for some unions, but perhaps not the same way for police unions? What is the position that you take?
You know, the history of the labor movement, I mean, if you want to really be honest, you know, the police was used as a tool against workers. If you look at the history of the labor movement, and used to brutalize, to break up strikes and worker rallies, et cetera. And I don't say that to sort of engender any kind of a hate for the police, but I say that because it's important for the labor movement to understand their history and what role they should be playing in this whole issue around police accountability. And that is, if you're about social justice, if you're about economic justice, and you're saying that economic justice is racial justice, right. You have to care also about what happens to Black and Brown workers when they leave the workplace and they return to their communities, right? Michael Brown earlier was shot and killed and left in the street for hours. His mother at work didn't even know. Michael Brown's mother was a unionized grocer, mm-hmm. a member of UFCW, mm-hmm. right? And we see how, again, how this issue is connected to workers, to Black workers, but also to people who are impacted by police violence, right? You know, you can't care about me as a worker. And then when I leave my workplace and I go home and I'm being brutalized, or my son being killed in the street and left for dead for hours, I am impacted by that as a worker, as a mother, as a Black person living in America, right? Sure. Yeah. And so that is a role that the labor movement should play. And so I am not opposed to any union, because I think unions play a role in advocating for their members, but what you advocate for, if it directly contradicts what the labor movement is about around social, economic, racial, environmental justice, then that is something that we should call out and distance ourselves from as people who care about the labor movement, care about workers' rights, and care about Black lives. And this is the moment, right, for unions and union leadership to say, look, we need to take a stand against police violence, and any union, right, or any police association that aligns itself against police transparency and accountability, we cannot stand in solidarity with those individuals and those unions, because that's what it looks like, right? That is what it looks like. All of these issues are intertwined.
Of course it's interconnected, right? And that's why, though, if police unions decide now, the legislators think they can do what they want, what if they have a slowdown? What is your response to that?
That speaks to really who they are and where policing is, if we ever get to that point, right?
How so?
Because if you are in essence saying that the laws that we passed that would ensure greater transparency and accountability, something that communities have been demanding for a very long time, right? Mm-hmm. That I am then not going to fulfill my oath to protect and serve the community, right, that I'm patrolling, then I think that speaks to the character and to the individuals who hold that belief rather than us or the community. Because, you know, and it really goes to a reimagining of public safety, because if this is the response to transparency and accountability, mm-hmm. Then I think it just speaks to a very deep and concerning culture within policing that we should all be concerned about. Because whenever—
But how do you address that? Yes, I agree with you. It is concerning, but how do you address it?
The only way that we could address that is by ensuring that we're recruiting the right people for this, right? Because not everyone can do this job and not everyone should do this job. And we're seeing that every single day.
All right, so let me ask you, how do you recruit correctly to be a police officer? What are your requirements then?
Well, for one, I think someone should certainly live in the community that they're serving. And I think if we look at police departments across the country, even Montgomery County, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of police do not live in the communities that they serve in. And so when you don't have that that connection to the community, or you don't see that community as somewhere where you live, then you're not as committed.
Okay, what about the argument that the police officers are not paid enough? Certainly teachers are not paid enough to live in the community, right? Well, how do you address that?
Well, I think, and that speaks to housing policy. Mm-hmm. I think public employees do not make enough.
Correct.
Right? Whether it's educators, whether it's law enforcement, whether it's the postal worker, we don't pay public employees enough. And I think the way that we sort of incentivize folks not only living and staying there, in their community and acknowledging the fact that Montgomery County is an expensive place to live.
Right.
What is our housing policy, right? What are we doing around affordable housing? And what are we doing around providing credits to those who want to live and stay in Montgomery County? I think there are a number of things that we
right.
can
so the
look
police
at.
Officer can say it's all very well to say that I should live in Montgomery County, Delegate Acevedo, but you know, you're not paying me enough to live here. So, you know, if you're going to do reforms, you should housing reform should be part of your package, and it ain't.
Well, housing policy is something that we address at the state level, but when we talk about Montgomery County and incentivizing folks to stay in Montgomery County, mm-hmm. I think that's more of like a local housing policy, right? What is being done? I think at the state level, and you've seen this in the past, we provided credits. I know the General Assembly has passed tax credits to ensure that folks are able to move and stay in the communities that they serve in. But I think it requires action, not just at the state level, but at the local level, especially, right? Because yes, states determine what is permissible policing, but policing is really state and it's largely a local function, right? And so local policy, local housing policy got to reflect what it is that we're talking about here.
I've heard people say that if police officers decide to quit as a consequence, or it becomes harder to find recruits. What if crime stats start to go up? Have you thought about that?
I don't see the data lines up with what folks are suggesting and saying. You know that mm-hmm. you know, like for instance, a lot of my colleagues were saying that, you know, if we pass these laws, it is going to impact police morale and hiring and recruiting. There's never really data to accompany this. Oh, we're seeing resignations of a ton of police officers as a result of this. New York passed some pretty significant police reform measures last year. Florida is looking at it. Colorado did. They ended qualified immunity in state court. You only hear this line, this narrative that really is used by some police chiefs and the FOP, halt action on police transparency and accountability, in my opinion. If you are leaving because we're passing police transparency and accountability laws, then you should not have been in the policing or law enforcement profession to begin with.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about what remains to be done. What are the things you think that remain to be done in Maryland around police reform and accountability?
During the House floor debates on the police accountability package, I offered a number of amendments that I think would have strengthened the already existing legislation at the time. And while those amendments didn't make it in, and these were, you know, issues that I was raising on the House work group since last year, I think it provides us with sort of like a roadmap to what it is that we still need to do. And that is, one, we need to address community oversight and control. I think a big part of this quote unquote reimagining of public safety, as a lot of folks talk about, it must mean community oversight and control over the way public safety is administered.
Specifically, what do you mean?
So in other words, what I'm talking about is civilian review boards with the investigative, subpoena, and disciplinary powers to look into and to make determinations on cases. So some jurisdictions have civilian review boards. Baltimore City has a civilian review board, but it does not have a TEEP. Right? It doesn't have a lot of power, the powers that I just described. And correct. That's what community oversight and control looks like, right? And this is not a novel idea. When we talk about community oversight and control of public safety, this is what HOAs do, homeowners associations, right? They contract with security companies. They determine who patrol their streets. They know who are patrolling their streets, right? And they determine how that happens. And if they're not pleased, then they look at another structure, right? So this is not a novel and uncommon idea. What we're advocating for is for real community oversight and control, and I think that's outstanding. The other thing is we need to address white nationalism in law enforcement. Congressman Jamie Raskin from the 8th Congressional District is the chair of the Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. Mm-hmm. And recently, as in last year, he released an unredacted FBI assessment on white supremacy and white nationalism in law enforcement in the United States. And it was a very, very, very troubling report. Not only did the report say that white nationalism is present within US law enforcement, but it is rampant. It has the potential to create a greater division between law enforcement and community because of racialized policing. If we don't address it, then that could mean that we're looking at a huge problem in the near future. And there were a couple of recommendations on what needed to be done at the federal level. But one thing that I'd like to see is us examining white nationalism within law enforcement in the United States. And so that was one of the amendments that I offered that would, in essence, charge the—
You mean Maryland?
Correct. The attorney general and the state police to not only look at, but to then report back to the General Assembly to specific committees on the extent. So then that could inform what kind of a legislation that we need.
Do you have any sense of how widespread the problem is in Maryland of white supremacy in the police?
And that's the thing. That was the purpose of my amendment, to find out the extent of that. What we know from the report that Congressman Jamie Raskin's subcommittee released is that white nationalism is very much present in US law enforcement. That's all across the country, right? Mm-hmm. So Maryland is not immune to that.
Why do you think that didn't go forward?
Politics.
Yeah, but we all like to hate politics, right? That's the entire—
I mean, there's really no other way to look at it because this was—
But what about politics?
This is an issue that I raised on the work group last year. Mm-hmm. I would have liked that we discussed, debated, and addressed it, and that be a part of the work group report that we put out. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it wasn't. The frustration that I have with the General Assembly is that, as a Democratic supermajority state legislature, we can go further on legislation, but we don't. And I'm often the one on the progressive wing of the party on the left saying, mm-hmm. no, we need to go further. Mm-hmm. I know we can go further, and either being seen as, you know, troublemaker is really politics, because we know we can go further, right? But we're not, because we believe that we've done enough, right? Enough to say that we've addressed this and we will come back to it. And when we talk about the issue of police violence, because police violence is not new to American public discourse, right? We've been having this conversation for a very long time, right? But specifically, Black people have been having this conversation with the rest of America for a very long time, mm-hmm. right? And we have not seen meaningful and comprehensive change over the years. We've seen some changes, some reforms, but not to the extent that impacted communities are calling for. And therein lies my frustration is, are we going as far as we need to and as far as impacted communities are calling us, because I'm asking us to go, because those closest to the pain are closest to the solution, but seldom are they closest to power. And it's our responsibility as legislators to listen, to look at the data, and then to listen to impacted communities and then legislate, but go as far as we can. And that's always a frustration for me, because I'm an impatient optimist and I know we'll get there, but this is one of those issues where I believe we just can't be incremental on, right? Incrementalism is not the approach to police violence. Never was, and it never should be.
Okay, Gabriel. Thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it.
It's always good to be in conversation. I appreciate, you just making the space for a topic like this.
What lessons can we draw from my conversation with Gabriel Acevero? First, the demand for police reform has been a long and spirited one. The killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor ignited a national movement. But the comparative question here is really why Maryland and not another state? One answer lies in the rapid change of leadership that occurred in the General Assembly in 2019 and 2020. In April 2019, the longtime Speaker of the Maryland House of Delegates, Mike Bush, died and was replaced by Adrienne Jones, the first African-American woman to be elected to that position. Over in the Senate, longtime President Mike Miller passed away in January 2020, and Bill Ferguson, a young Democrat born in Silver Spring but representing Baltimore City, became the new Senate president. Several downstream changes followed. Speaker Jones created a work group to look at police reforms that would form the basis of the new legislative package. Without the preparatory work of the work group, the new legislation would have been unlikely, or at least unlikely, in 2021. Second, two key elements of the new reforms, use of force standard and transparency in officer misconduct, were part of Anton's Law, a bill Gabriel Acevero had worked on since 2018. Acevero, together with Anton's Law co-sponsor Senator Jill Carter, joined the legislative work group on public safety. Carter became the chair. It's not surprising that the key provisions of Anton's Law made it into the new reforms. Third, the Maryland Police Training and Standards Commission, a body comprised primarily of police officers, chiefs, sheriffs, has the ability to interpret the new legislative language into actionable training and standards for state police departments. How new standards and training will emerge is unclear. The police unions have opposed measures, and rather than inertly accept the new directions, we are likely to see contestation over how the new law comes into force. Lastly, police reforms are work in progress. Gabriel Acevero mentioned civilian oversight boards being armed with subpoena powers and an investigation into white supremacy in law enforcement in Maryland. He is also deeply involved in removing police presence from schools. All those are highly contested issues, and we will continue to follow them. We end this episode with the voices of two students from public schools not in the western part of the county.
Can you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Jude.
And what's your school situation right now?
I just went back to in-person.
What grade are you in?
8th grade.
How often do you go to school?
Every school day except for Wednesday on every other week.
And what surprised you most about going back to school?
The schedule for dismissing things.
How come that was surprising?
Because if you walk or ride a car, you're supposed to go last.
Okay. And what did you find the most silly or ridiculous about going back to school?
Same as what I just said.
What did you like best about going back to school?
Playing instrument, since I do orchestra. And I actually was able to play my instrument with a group of people.
And you hadn't been able to do that?
Nope.
I would just say that, like, it was very disorganized in that they didn't really have a plan for what they were doing. And, for example, we were supposed to have this recess for, like, 15 minutes, and all it was sitting or standing on pavement, not being allowed to move for 20 minutes. And that was it, and everyone was sort of laughing to themselves about how ridiculous it was.
That's all for this episode. The interlude and going out music for this episode comes from a new locally written musical, Sunflower, the story of Amelie and Vincent, which was composed by Washington, D.C. music teacher Premila Mistry and her formerly Northern Virginia-based collaborator Laura Gulley. You can find the musical on iTunes. I'm very much looking forward to showcasing local talent and especially local music students on the podcast. If you want to share your music on the show or know someone who might want to, please email us at ihppod@gmail.com or reach out on Twitter at ihppod. I hope you will subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and your home. See you next time.
Everyone loves a hero. Vincent Van Gogh, is that for me? Even though his life ended tragically, he painted life with colors, humbly and creatively. And most of all, his painting inspired me. Everyone loves a hero, someone strong, someone brave, someone to look up to and save the day. I used to think that heroes meant a lot of friends and praise. They don't fail, they don't cry. I didn't know that maybe even I can be the hero I want to see. There's someone strong and someone kind.